Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you very much, Liz, for that generous introduction. I thank HIRIOC for the opportunity to speak here today as well. And before I commence my discussion, I would also like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the country on which we meet and pay my respects to their elders, both past and present. My presentation today is going to focus on a few things. I'm going to whiz through it so that we've got some time for questions. But up there is a quote from the Declaration of Indigenous People on Climate Change, which was given at The Hague in November 2000. That will become apparent to the first part of my presentation shortly. Policy and legal reform by governments in response to climate change has become a priority and will continue to happen quickly. Changes are likely to be complex, and the legal issues associated with these changes and their interactions with Indigenous people are numerous and varied. It is imperative that consultation processes around these changes are accessible to all stakeholders and interest groups, particularly Indigenous people. As I mentioned, my presentation today will discuss a few things. It will discuss Indigenous people's participation in responses to climate change, both nationally and internationally. I'll look at trying to protect and growing a space for Indigenous people in terms of their participation in climate change responses. And finally, and very briefly, I'll touch on the impacts of climate change and what sorts of options for redress for damage and loss caused by climate change there may be for Indigenous people. These are all topics on which the Social Justice Commissioner, Tom Carmer, has published and discussed in many forums, along with other Indigenous leaders. In Australia to date, there has been little space afforded for dialogue and collaboration with Indigenous people about responses to climate change. This is reflective of a similar issue internationally, where Indigenous people have needed to strongly assert their right to participate in global discussions and strategies to address climate change. Ever since the creation of the Framework Convention on Climate Change in 1992 and the subsequent Kyoto Protocol, Indigenous people have raised their concerns about Kyoto mechanisms, in particular carbon markets, in many international forums. These concerns include that market incentives for carbon sinks will lead to large-scale forest plantations and a consequent loss of traditional country and ecosystems, and that measures to mitigate climate change are based on a worldview of territory that reduces forests, lands, seas and sacred sites to their carbon-absorbing capacity. Forest trees and other vegetations are used to indicate country as well as provide shade, nourishment, medicines, tools and other resources for Indigenous people. Further, trees and vegetation, animals and insects are used as bioindicators for the timing of certain practices and for seasons. As such, trees and vegetation are enmeshed with native title, cultural and intellectual property rights. The 2000 Declaration of Indigenous People on Climate Change at The Hague sets out the position of Indigenous people on the Framework Convention of Climate Change and Kyoto Protocol. This position has been reiterated and built upon since 2000 by Indigenous people at subsequent climate change conferences and through the work of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. In 2008, the UN Permanent Forum identified that a key barrier to the realisation of Indigenous people's coping and adaptation capacities is the lack of recognition and promotion of their human rights. Many of these rights are reflected in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Indigenous people have a special interest in this issue, not only through their physical and spiritual relationships with land, water and associated ecosystems, they are particularly vulnerable to climate change, but also because they have specialised ecological and traditional knowledge, which is very relevant to finding the best fit solutions to climate change. The importance of traditional knowledge is promoted in a number of international instruments, including the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity, which is largely embodied, or Australia has largely embodied, some of its principles in the Domestic Commonwealth Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act. A key object of this domestic act is to promote a partnership approach to the environmental protection and biodiversity conservation through recognising and promoting Indigenous people's role in and knowledge of the conservation and ecologically sustainable use of biodiversity. apologies, it looks like it's slipped off the bottom of the slide, the bottom principle. Fundamental rights and freedoms set out in the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous People support the participation of Indigenous peoples in climate change strategies and responses. The Declaration also recognises that and respects Indigenous knowledge, and sets out that Indigenous knowledge, cultures and traditional practices contribute to sustainable and equitable development and the proper management of the environment. Among other relevant provisions set out in the Declaration is that Indigenous people have the right to participate in decision-making in matters which would affect their rights. The importance of this particular article will become apparent, more apparent, I should say, shortly. Australia has stepped up its responses to climate change since ratifying the Kyoto Protocol and taking a lead role in negotiations at the Framework Convention Conference of the Parties in Bali last year. Two recent and prominent developments, as mentioned by John, are the Gano Climate Change Review, which was commissioned by states and territories, and the federal government's Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme Green Paper, which was released not long ago in July. I note the positive signal from both the Gano Review and Federal Government Green Paper that acknowledges the potential contribution that Indigenous people can make to mitigate the impacts of climate change, noting particularly a traditional fire management project in the Northern Territory and Indigenous land managers in the forestry context. However, it is important not to particularise and limit the spectrum of possible projects in which Indigenous people can and have a right to participate. Australia's mitigation and adaptation responses to climate change need to be interdisciplinary and multifaceted in order to comprehensively address the causes and effects of the potential impacts. This involves economic and social change, however, also clearly and inextricably involves protection of the environment and conservation of biological diversity. As such, Australia's response should not ignore the objects of existing domestic legislation or the international instruments to which it is a party, or to which it has signalled it will become a party, or is likely to become a party. The Charter of United Nations, the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, all affirm the fundamental importance of the right to self-determination of all people. This includes a freedom and right to pursue economic, social and cultural development. Climate policy and mitigation strategies present a key opportunity to bring traditional knowledge and practices and economic markets together. It should not be passed over by mainstreaming responses in a way that fails to accommodate the particular concerns and specialised interests of Indigenous people. In the context of development opportunities, the following examples outline ways in which Indigenous people are currently contributing, formally and informally, to environmental services through carbon abatement projects. They illustrate some of the tangible and intangible assets of Indigenous communities that may be realised through meaningful and respectful partnership and investment. The first example is the West Arnhem Land Fire Abatement Project, which some of you may have heard about. This is a carbon offset project in Western Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory. The West Arnhem Land Fire Management Agreement effectively establishes a partnership between the Darwin Liquefied Natural Gas Plant, the Northern Territory Government, the Northern Land Council and traditional owners from coastal Maningrida and the headwaters of the Catherine and Mann Rivers. Shown on the slide is a map of the West Arnhem Land Fire Management Agreement area. The project was formed to implement strategic fire management for the purposes of offsetting greenhouse gas emissions from a natural gas plant in Darwin Harbour. Under the agreement, private industry will contribute a minimum of $1 million per year to the project over 17 years. The West Arnhem Land Fire Abatement Project, which I'll refer to as WELFAP, reduces greenhouse gas emissions by adapting traditional fire management practices in what is mostly unmanaged land, which is prone to unchecked wildfire. Unchecked wildfires contribute to over 40% of the Northern Territory's greenhouse gas emissions and to around 2% of Australia's national emissions. The project has direct and collateral ecological benefits by reducing the net greenhouse gas emissions caused by wildfire and also by conserving the environmental and cultural values in the adjacent World Heritage listed Kakadu National Park. The project employs local Aboriginal land management rangers and facilitates and supports the transfer of Indigenous knowledge between generations as elders work alongside young people as part of the project. The gas plant has agreed to offset its greenhouse gas emissions as part of its licensing arrangements with the Northern Territory Government. And the agreement is obviously attractive to the private sector as it enables industry to address permit requirements in a manner designed to achieve economic, social and environmental outcomes. While this project has aspects that are somewhat specific to the northern savannah region of Australia, the premise of creating an offset project through partnering with Indigenous landowners or managers clearly has application to elsewhere in Australia. Indigenous people in Australia have long performed activities which generate commodity and non-commodity services for all Australians from the natural environment. Many environmental services performed by Indigenous people are not new to federal, state and territory governments. Government departments and agencies have been involved in joint and cooperative management arrangements with Indigenous people for some time. However, the current threats of climate change and associated low carbon context creates the need to more appropriately value these services and provide adequate financial and regulatory infrastructure to enable access to and growth of these new opportunities. Patch burning of the Matu people in the northwestern section of the Western Desert is another example of a broader public benefit arising from traditional practices. The Matu people hold native title over the determination area in Western Australia, which is shown on this map here, and it's up not too far from the Kimberley and Pilbara region in Western Australia. This example, discussed in recent work of the Desert Knowledge CRC and others, women undertake most of the burning activity, which reveals tracks and dens of small burrowing animals, such as lizards, pythons and feral cats, and immediately improves hunting efficiency, so its primary purpose is for a hunting practice. The patch burnt areas resulting from the women's use of fire has the collateral benefit of mitigating wildfires in the summer months and in sustaining the biodiversity of this area of the Western Desert. The minimisation of more intense wildfires preserves trees and shrubs and increases the capacity of this ecosystem to maintain carbon sequestration. A common issue in relation to both the WELFAP and MATU examples is the vulnerability of these projects to changes in policy and support structures. This reiterates the need for meaningful rights surrounding engagement processes. Water rights are a reoccurring and key issue underpinning meaningful engagement and participation in development opportunities for Indigenous people. In Australia, these founding blocks remain very wobbly, despite suggestions by Justice Woodward in 1974, some 34 years ago, in what is known as the Woodward Report, that provision of land rights was one way to facilitate economic development in Indigenous communities. In Australia at present, it may be possible to use communal freehold rights under various forms of land rights legislation, freehold land grants as part of native title settlement packages, and or Indigenous land corporation properties for environmental market opportunities. More certain legal tenure provides greater scope to use land for economic development. However, the restricted treatment of most forms of Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander rights and interests in land and water can limit the involvement of Indigenous communities. Scope also exists. Shows the ILC properties, Indigenous Land Corporation properties across Australia at the moment. It's a little difficult to see, but all the dotted areas are small hectareage. The large areas are large hectareage. So you can see at the moment there's actually very little freehold land held, and whether it's been actually divested to Indigenous people is a secondary question. Scope also exists for other opportunities through collaborative projects relating to climate change and environmental management, which support shared understandings about country. For example, as mentioned by John, the existing Caring for Country programs may be one way to promote further development, but also projects such as the Indigenous Weather Knowledge Project. Intellectual property is an important issue in these collaborative projects, being the protection of traditional knowledge. Inadequate legal protections for the unique nature of Indigenous traditional knowledge means that agreements and contracts need to provide adequate and appropriate protections. Greater acknowledgement and support is needed for Indigenous people to grow development opportunities associated with climate mitigation activities, which also serve in the public interest. At present, traditional knowledge and ecological services provided by Indigenous people are informal, undervalued, and often undersupported. Turning to more contemporary developments, in terms of the carbon pollution reduction scheme proposal by the federal government. There are three salient issues concerning the interaction between a new emissions trading scheme and Indigenous people in Australia. Firstly, Indigenous people have unique cultural interests, economic development aspirations and legal rights and interests that should be respected, preserved and promoted where they intersect with the new carbon pollution reduction scheme. Indigenous people possess many tangible and intangible assets that may be realised through meaningful and respectful partnerships and investment. As significant landholders, especially in Northern Australia, the contribution of Indigenous people to mitigation efforts needs to be recognised as a major component of the national mitigation effort. The opportunities for projects similar to the WellFAP project has been created by a growing consideration of greenhouse gas emissions in the context of development and environmental approvals. However, the growth and applications of projects like this outside the northern savannah region may be limited under the proposed carbon pollution reduction scheme. The broad coverage of the proposed scheme limits the scope for activities outside for outside offset credits. The specific exclusion of the savannah emissions may be seen as a positive development for certain Indigenous projects in Northern Australia, and it is promising that the government has identified the need to consult with Indigenous land managers about issues raised in the Green Paper. However, this consultation will need to be extensive if it is to capture the full spectrum of important ways traditional land management practices and knowledge can contribute to viable offset and mitigation projects nationally. It certainly will be interesting to see how these consultations and linkage proposals develop in the months to come. Another key access issue in the context of market opportunities is financial assistance. Carbon projects take time, require financial and human resources. There's a lot of steps to go through. Some of them are very technical and they often require a number of consultants. Although the government has allocated $10 million nationally to encourage and promote Indigenous access to carbon markets, it's unlikely that this amount will suffice nationally. It's imperative and consistent with a human rights-based approach to ensure Indigenous interests are not marginalised in the face of an emerging policy, law and technology. Innovations and changes create demands for more efficient processing, new low-carbon technology, renewable energy and investment in carbon sequestration. New laws, regulation and policy contain certain opportunities as outlined, yet also bring complexity to dealing with Indigenous peoples, particularly in relation to land and natural resource use and development. For example, in preparing for sequestration development, Australian states and territories have legislated to provide a basis for the legal recognition of carbon rights in trees. The nature of these carbon rights varies across jurisdictions within Australia, and the interaction between carbon rights in trees and other legal interests, including native title, is complex. In Australia, native title and other systems for Indigenous land return, cultural heritage, environment and property laws, along with human rights, provide the mechanisms for possible protection and advancement of Indigenous interests in these new environmental markets. However, many of these laws and interests are vulnerable and do not create a well-protected space for Indigenous people. New climate change related laws, regulations and markets may further decrease or limit Indigenous people's rights and interests through the extinguishment or suspension of native title and by restricting rights in relation to the access and use of land, natural and biological resources. Free, prior and informed consent is clearly an important requirement in these circumstances, where the grant of other interests in land, trees or water may restrict the use and enjoyment of an area or resource for the duration of that third party interest. It is imperative that new regulations preserve the existing rights and interests of Indigenous people in Australia and use the space created by these existing rights to grow interests into the future. As outlined, it is possible for Indigenous people to substantially engage in climate mitigation opportunities, but it's also possible for Indigenous groups to participate in climate related litigation. Undeniably linked to environmental damage is damage to Indigenous people's culture, cultural heritage and identity. The devastation of sacred sites, burial places and hunting and gathering spaces, not to mention a changing and eroding landscape, caused great distress to Indigenous people. As mentioned by John, there are strong indications that communities in Northern Australia, the Torres Strait and Murray-Darling Basin are already affected by impacts of climate change. Climate change litigation is not purely an environmental legal issue. The nexus between environmental law and human rights law is established at an international level. By way of example, In 2005, the Arctic Inuit people petitioned the American government at an Inter-American Human Rights Commission to establish mandatory limits on greenhouse gas emissions to help the Arctic Inuit people adapt to unavoidable impacts of climate change. A key argument advanced in the petition was that impacts of in the Arctic of human-induced climate change infringe upon the environment, subsistence, and other human rights of Inuit people. In February 2008, the Alaskan native village of Kivalina filed a lawsuit against a number of oil, coal and power companies for their contribution to global warming and the impacts on homes and country disappearing into the Chukchi Sea. The village is facing relocation due to sea erosion and the deteriorating coast. The Kivalina seek monetary damages for the defendants' past and ongoing contributions to global warming, public nuisance and damages caused by certain defendants' acts in conspiring to suppress the awareness of the link between their emissions and global warming. Further legal action taken by communities in Nigeria against Shell and other oil companies in relation to gas flaring and associated pollution was successful on environmental and human rights grounds. In this context, the adoption of the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples by the UN General Assembly in September 2007 is a further step toward the promotion and protection of fundamental human and cultural rights of Indigenous people. In Australia to date, climate-related litigation has focused on administrative action in planning and environment decisions with varying degrees of success. These proceedings are part of a growing body of climate change jurisprudence, and it is worth noting discussion and debate in academic circles about the scope for negligence and nuisance actions in Australia as seen in the US. To finish, it is apparent that climate change and increased environmental awareness present an opportunity to support Indigenous peoples' exercise of a right to development in accordance with their needs, interests and aspirations. It's in everyone's interests for Indigenous people as important knowledge holders and land managers not to be excluded from collaborative engagement and partnerships with the private and public sector in responses to climate change. In my view, progress in a carbon-constrained future should obviously involve collaboration and opportunity over litigation. However, the pathway will no doubt be shaped by the action or inaction of government and the private sector. The Australian Government, despite yet not having adopted the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, should perhaps endeavour to follow these principles, responsibilities and obligations as set out in the Declaration. It would appear to be a departure from best practice for governments not to consult with and cooperate in good faith with Indigenous people in order to obtain their free, prior and informed consent before adopting and implementing legislative or administrative measures that may affect them. To borrow a phrase from some of my former clients, traditional owners in northwest Victoria, which was often used in their negotiations with the state, it's definitely time to put some flesh on the bones of these agreements and principles. Thank you.